everyone, and just make a few preliminary announcements. Of course, thank everyone for coming. Thank Ellie Lassen for his help in arranging this. Thank Pam Lehman, who has a prior commitment tonight, but was very involved in soliciting the different host homes for the series. Of course, in particular, we want to thank this evening the Freeds for hosting and taking this opportunity. To mention that this particular installment of the series will be Le'ilui Nishmas Shemar Yohu Ben Chaim Moshe Ginsburg, his grandfather, and the who's a grandfather and the be sponsored by his parents Marsha and Milton Fried and Neshama should have an Aliyah. Just thanked you. We mentioned that you had a conflict. Look at that, Baruch Hashem. Well, the Gula is all about Nisim, so. Baruch Hashem, we have to start a little Nisim at a time. Okay. I want to start by, I want to start with a little bit, one story, which is an over-introduction to the entire series, as well as a little bit of history. The story is something that I heard on a tape from Rabbi Fran years ago, so I hope I'm getting it more or less correct and accurate, because I haven't heard it in a while. But it goes essentially as follows, that years ago, Rav Zev Gold, who was the leader of the World Mizrahi Movement, came to Baltimore. And he was an old friend of Rav Ruderman Zatzal's from Slobodka. And he stayed with Rav Ruderman. Meanwhile, while he was in Baltimore, he had different meetings with the Baltimore Zionist District and the Baltimore Religious Zionist District and different Mizrahi groups. And at one point, when they found out where he was staying, some of them apparently were very upset at Rav Gold. How could you stay at Rav Ruderman's? Nicht Zionist! It's not one of us, how could you do it? And apparently Rav Zev Gold replied, you're right, but with him, I only have 612 mitzvos in common. With you, unfortunately, I have far less. But we have this one thing in common. So I say this to you just because even though essentially the whole gist of this series is to explore, for lack of a better way term, the divisions within the Orthodox community over, as I put on the flyer, the blurb of the flyer, Zionism and the establishment of the State of Israel, we shouldn't lose sight, no matter what we see tonight or the next 2 weeks, we shouldn't lose sight of the big picture. The big picture is despite the important and, as I say, oftentimes impassioned debate within our committee about this issue, we should realize, as important an issue as it is one value of many. Maybe it's important, more important than some, less important than others, but it really is only a piece of the puzzle of who we are. And we have to realize that whatever individuals in this room, and I'm not sure everyone in this room would agree anyway, but whatever individuals believe, there should be a sense, certainly I believe this to be correct, of the overriding commonality that exists within the Orthodox community. Sometimes we make too much of our differences than what we have in common, and I guess in a certain sense, this series is guilty of that. Except for that this is a hopefully total L'shem Shemayim, and not L'shem Machlokas. So that's the story, that's something to keep in mind. Second, I'm not remotely a historian, the purpose of this is not supposed to be a history lecture, but at the same time, just as a quick review of some of the basic information, and I jotted this down largely from memory, so if the dates are slightly off, please don't hold me to a historian's standard. But just to give you a sense of the timeline of some of the things that we're talking about. Because obviously a lot happened before 1948. Someone asked me this evening at shul how far I was going back. Was I talking about the Vilna Gaon? He was sent to Aliyah. That was the first Aliyah of modern time. So that far I'm not going back. I said I'm really using the timeline of the secular Zionist movement. More or less. So just to give you a sense, I'm starting essentially from the mid-1800s. And there was about 10,000 Jews in Eretz Israel. It was around that time that Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer was probably the first founder of the Frum, what we would call religious Zionist. He started advocating Aliyah. I think it was around 1884 that the Chovei Tzion movement was founded, which was for promoting religious Aliyah. That already was a little bit controversial. The Netziv, among others, was a proponent of Chovei Tzion. The Gezochon Inspector was as well. And at the same time, one of the great Rosh Hashivas at the time, Rav Lazer Gordon, again, among others, there were many, but just to give you some names, he was against it. Why? Because one of the heads of Chofetz Chaim was a fellow named Leon Pitzker, who was a maskil. He was too intellectual. He was a free thinker. That already made things. And that's already just in microcosm the tension that has often existed. Over the next few years, this movement or this general sense of Aliyah got increasingly secular, and obviously the tension within the Frum community grew. In 1896, I believe it was, Herzl founded the World Zionist Organization and Congress, and he published his famous book, The Jewish State, which explicitly advocates a secular return to Zion. And just to give you a sense again of also of how secular was. So 1899, there was a Zionist preacher who compared Herzl and one of the other leaders, Nordau, to Moshe Rabbeinu and Hashem. They're the new Ro'im, they're the new leaders, and they're going to lead us out, castigating the Frum community. Mashiach hasn't come, you've been waiting and you've been waiting, there's not going to be a Mashiach, we have to take this into our own hands. Moshe Rabbeinu is Herzl is the Mashiach, Herzl is the new Moshe Rabbeinu. You can imagine why this has been controversial within the Frum community. Things started moving in a very concrete way in 1903. That was when the British colonial secretary Chamberlain offered a Jewish homeland in Africa. That's the famous Uganda proposal. I'm not sure if everyone knows, or how many people know how close that actually came to occurring. This was the debate even within the secular Zionists. This, I mentioned the two names. Nordau opposed. Herzl was for it. There was a big shootout, a big showdown. I mentioned this morning the World Zionist Congress and the convention. So at the one that year, there was a major vote. Who knows the vote? Anyone know who won that vote? The pro-African forces won the vote, 295 to 175, with a little under 100 abstentions. So you'll ask, how come we didn't go to Africa? Again, there could be this part of the story that I don't know or don't remember, but what sticks out in my mind was because in 1904, at a very young age, Herzl died. And as often is the case, especially with a controversial movement or decision, when the leader and the opponent, the strong one, is no longer on this thing, kind of fell apart, Baruch Hashem. But if he hadn't died, I think he was in his 40s when he died, if I'm not mistaken. If he hadn't died, who knows how history could have been different. In 1917, the British Foreign Secretary Balfour sends a letter to Rothschild, which he famously says he would view with favor the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. In 1919, at the Paris Peace Conference, the international community begins to accept this Balfour proposal. And very importantly, significantly, we'll see this quoted even on the sources shortly, in 1921, the League of Nations and San Remo essentially vote to give the British the authority to fulfill the pledges and the promises or commitments spelled out in the Balfour Declaration. And almost at the end of this, so to speak, another critical date, pre-state, is in May of 1937. The Peel Commission, as you know, I'm skipping obviously a lot, but there was increasing aliyah, and there's increasing tension with the Arabs. There's the Hebron massacres. A lot of things are going on. So the British appoint this fellow Peel to investigate. What's going on? What? And in fact, Peel at first wants to say maybe we should, if there's all these problems, maybe we should limit the amount of Jews who are coming into Eretz Israel. And among other things, he asked Winston Churchill, and an incredible quote. Who knows? You never know with the Mike Azachi, what people have schism for. But Winston Churchill certainly accomplished much in his life. And maybe it's because he was one of the people who, as I understand it, they're persuasive to say, why are you blaming the victims, so to speak? In other words, why is it a crime for people who want to come live peacefully and cultivate the land? He saw this, again, he wasn't in terms of Jewish religion per se, but he saw, look, the brachos that come from the land when the Jews are there, the economy, it'll be more money for everybody. You know, why aren't the criminals, so to speak, the ones who let the land, who were in the land for a thousand of years and nothing came of it? So, among other things, he persuaded them, and obviously the Peel Commission ended up recommending, it was either June or July of that year, recommending partition. It was dividing up into six parts, I think it was. The Jewish part was going to be very small. The British were going to retain international control over Yerushalayim. But certainly in light of the 2,000-year Golus, it was a big deal. It was obviously a very, very big deal. And of course, November 47, the vote, and Hakamas HaMedina shortly thereafter. So that's just a very, very brief history, just to get a timeline, to get a sense of things. And obviously, you know, looking back in retrospect, sometimes things are very clear. Not always, but sometimes. This is incredible, totally unparalleled in our history, and this is kind of the stuff that's happening. the religious community, the Rabbanim, are trying to figure out each step along the way how to deal with it. I already alluded to some of the tensions, but we'll see some more. Okay. If you look, turn to your first book. I would like to more or less structure tonight's shiur, focusing on primarily three objections over the years that people have given to, again, what we're calling Zionism, or again, a certain nationalistic fervor and movement back towards Eretz Yisrael. Because again, if one would just think about it for a moment, if you, when someone dropped you here from planet Mars, you just read the Torah a little bit, and they gave you some brief history of biblical Jewish history. So I think it would be like astounding to think that anyone could possibly be against anything having to do with people coming to Eretz Yisrael. What do you mean? Jews going to Eretz Yisrael, what could be bad about that? So the answer is that would be simplistic. It's very complicated. So in light of that, so to speak, I think, despite, on the one hand it's simplistic, on the other hand, the connection between us and Eretz Yisrael is an obvious one, and therefore, I think in a certain sense, Alayhem Lahavi Raya, what is it, why would one be against? So that's, again, just as a set structure, what I would like to do. The bulk of the shiur I want to spend on what is the most famous, if you will, halachic argument against the mass aliyah that I alluded to and that was taking place in the end of the 19th century and obviously to this very day. And this essentially is what is known as the three oaths, the Gimel Shavuos. This comes from the Gemara in the end of Masechet Ketubos. It's the first source on your sheet on the top right-hand corner. And the Gemara tells us here, based originally on a pasuk in Shir HaShirim, in Perek Beis, Ishvat Yeschem Benos Yerushalayim, uses the term of an oath, a swearing. Now again, if you actually read the pasuk as a pshat, it makes no sense in terms of the continuation of the Gemara. It's a big drush to go from that pasuk to what the Gemara then brings it to. But that's the, you look inside if you want to share shirim, you'll see what the pasuk actually refers to. There's another pasuk from there that they use for a second shua, a third pasuk from somewhere else that they use. The bottom line, what the Gemara then brings out from these psukim, the Gemara says that pasuk itself tells us one of the shavuos, and then the Gemara in fact summarizes. The easiest way to do is to look at the summary. If you look at the end of the first wide line, the Gemara summarizes the discussion. It says, it's Rav Yossi, Rav Chanina, the Amar, second wide line, Gimel Shavuos Halalu Lama. What are these three O's we're talking about? So the Gemara tells us and lists them. Achas, which is the one that's most relevant for us. Shelo Ya'alu Yisrael Bachoma. Bachoma means a wall. Obviously, it's meant as a metaphor that the Jews should not go back en masse to Eretz Yisrael and Aliyah. If you look at the top, you'll see a little three-word Rashi. We'll get back to this Rashi. It's a very critical one. Rashi says, what is the metaphor of a wall? Yachad b'yad chazaka. United and somehow with force or strength. We're not supposed to have that kind of a mass Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. Again, one thing that's obvious, which even the Satmar Rebbe was more than happy to acknowledge, and certainly true throughout history, of course, that individual Jews moving to Eretz Yisrael, what could obviously be wrong with that? But the idea of a nationalistic movement, which is what we're talking about, advocated whether by the Chofetz Tzion, the idea of an en masse, so that seems to go against this first shua. What's important, of course, is to read the continuation. But achas, what's after that? Shehishbiah HaKadosh Baruch Hu es Yisrael shel yimredu b'umas olam. While we're in Golus, we shouldn't be troublemakers. We shouldn't rebel against our host nations. And finally, very importantly, v'achas shishbiya kadosh baruch hu es ha'ovdei kochavim leishtabdu behen b'Yisrael yoser minai. A little gullus, they're allowed. They can give us a hard time, so to speak. But they shouldn't persecute us too much. You go tell me what too much means.
What is the source
to it? These are the, again, I'm paraphrasing, I'm just reading you a snippet of the Gemara, but the Gemara derives these three sources from three different psukim that are quoted here. Three different, again, but it's not that if you'll open up a Tanakh, you'll see these spelled out. All of these psukim that are quoted are very metaphorical, but the Torah Shabbal Fed, the Masorah of understanding these psukim, is these three oaths. Again, the one that's most pertinent for us is the first one. Shelo Ya'alu Yisrael Bachoma. Now, where does this become a halachic imperative? Where does this, so to speak, gain prominence? You can bring up, Julie, maybe just bring up, that's what I'm saying, you just keep your, just the aisle here in front. There you go. There's, of course, always a front seat available. Yeah, there's always a front seat available. One of the classical areas that we have of halachic text is the Rambam's Sefer HaMitzvot. The Rambam lists the 613 Mitzvot. The Ramban has a commentary on that, in which he, among other things, lists Mitzvot which he thinks the Rambam left out. One of the famous examples of that is the Mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, the Mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. The Rambam never quotes that as one of the 613 Mitzvot, and the Ramban argues on him and says that that should be counted. What the Rambam's position is, why he didn't leave it, why he didn't count it. So this was actually a Thursday night shiur. It was the second, when we began 2 years ago or so, the Thursday night taburas, this was the second one, Parshas Lech Lecha. So that's, we've done that, so to speak, maybe we'll repeat it, but not tonight. It's online. Ellie says it's online. So why is this, why am I telling you this? Because one of the running commentators on that debate is Mr. De Leon, who wrote a parish called the Megillas Esther, not to be confused with the Sefer Tanakh by the same name, but he wrote a commentary in which he defends the Rambam from the Ramban's charges. So the Ramban is saying, oh, you should have counted the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. How come the Rambam didn't quote that mitzvah? So if you look on the left-hand side, Miguel Assessor says he doesn't understand the Ramban. Where's the Ramban coming from? After all, I'm reading the underlined part. The Vishim Mitzvah, Yerusha Saris, Vishivasa, Lo Nega Rak B'Yemei Moshe Yoshua. The whole mitzvah of Yerusha was limited to biblical times. B'choz Man Shlo Golo Me'artzam, before we were dispersed out of Israel. We were sent into Golos. Now that we've been sent into Golos and we're living out of Eretz Israel, Ein mitzvah zuno heges ladaros ad eis bo HaMashiach. There's no more mitzvah, there's no sense of a Jewish national homeland until Mashiach comes. Ki adarabba, yistavinu l'fishama sh'amru b'sof k'subis shalom nimrod v'umos alechas l'chbosh esaretz b'chazoka. On the contrary, says Miguel Sester, of course there's no mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. The Gemara says, Shlo Ya'alu B'choma, we're not supposed to be trying to retake our homeland in Eretz Yisrael. So how can the Rambam, how can the Ramban think that's the mitzvah? On the contrary, apparently that mitzvah was only suspended in time, be returned whenever Mashiach will come. So you see from this Megillat Esther that he viewed this Gemara in Subas with real teeth. It's a real halachic text, which he understands in a very radical way. But seriously, that obviously, there's no more mitzvah. It suspends the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And while it's true that most, just to be honest, most achronim, as I said, on that Thursday night I gave a shiur, so this is only one explanation. Most explanations assume much differently than him. And we'll have to see, this is the part of the continuation of the shiur, other understandings of this Gemara, which perhaps would mitigate against his conclusion. However, where this becomes directly relevant to the issues we're discussing, meaning practical and not just academic, are that among others, although it happened certainly before him, but to give you the most famous example, the Satmar Rebbe, the Hatzadik Lebracha, was again incredible, not only a Tzadik, he was an incredible genius. When you read his stuff, and we'll be reading parts of it, not that necessarily one comes away agreeing with him or not, that's a different question, but you really are awed by how brilliant and unbelievable Tom Chacham he was. So, the Satmar Rebbe's famous book is known as Vayoel Moshe. Vayoel Moshe is actually three separate essays. I forget what the middle one is called. The last one is called Maimer Lashon HaKodesh, which is a screed, at least initially, against modern Hebrew, because that's not Lashon HaKodesh. Inyan, parenthetically in there, he gets into his discussion of girls' education, which, as you may know, is very extreme. His major, the person he's attacking, or the group he's attacking there, is not, if you will, the modern Orthodox. He's not interested in issues of Gemara. He's attacking the Beis Yaakov movement. How dare they teach girls Chumash with Rashi? I'm not kidding you. And if you'll note, to this very day, Satmar has their own schools, and it's a radically different curriculum, even than the most right-wing Beis Yaakov. It's a completely different curriculum. That is, if you're looking for sources on that issue, you go to the third essay, the back of the book. But what I'm interested in is the opening essay, which is his most famous one. And guess what it's called? Maimer Shalosh Shavuos. The whole premise of his argument that the whole notion of Zionism and the modern state, it's all 100% anti-halakha. Again, he throws in 100 arguments. But the premise, the underlying premise, which is the title of the whole essay, is it runs against the Gemara, as is understood by the Megillas Esther. The whole thing is usher. Period. If you want to live there, it's a nice place to live. But there's no more mitzvah, and there's certainly, you can't do it en masse. It's all terrible. Final thing before I'll take a question, just to set it up. While it's most famous in our day, and most radically understood by the Satmar Rebbe, to give you a slightly more mainstream, if you will, in the general scheme of things, Gadol, again, certainly well-respected, his Torah study to this very day, was the great Stipler Gaon, Satsav Maxwell Kinevsky, lived in Bnei Brak, in Eretz Yisrael, didn't die that long ago, wrote a prolific commentary on Shas called the Kilas Yaakov, which we study to this very, very day. So there's a sefer that they published of his letters called the Krinid Igrisa. And if in the letter number 205, he is discussing here the following issue. Again, depending on where you're coming from, some of these questions sound almost funny. But in the non- or anti-Zionist world, certainly nowadays with political parties, you find this amusing. But originally, it was a major debate whether the religious community, and certainly the ultra-Orthodox community, would be involved in the government of the State of Israel. Should they have parties, and should they vote? These are major, major shadows in that community. And the Stipler was sent a letter. The Satmar Rebbe, to this very day, they held, it's usher to join into the government. You can't vote, you can't be a party, you can't be a politician. It's all usher. So they asked the Stipler if he agrees with that. And if you read the letter carefully, you'll look on the right-hand side, he quotes the following. Iger Tainis Ha'admor Rabbi HaKadosh Misatmer Shlita Machmas Gimel Shavuos Eino Muvan Lani Yisaiti. The Stipler says, I don't agree with the Satmar Rebbe. But catch what he agrees with first before he disagrees. Bavadai b'tchila haya shalokidin. It sounds like what he's saying is, yeah, the establishment of the State of Israel was actually usher, in his opinion. Avalaksha v'shein shilton acher b'nu. What are you going to do? It happens. It's not the British. It's not the Ottomans. It's not the Turks. They're Jews. They call themselves Israelis. It's the State of Israel. Nu. L'chora l'ke Yisra mitzad ha'gimel shavuos. Now it happened already. Now you got to live in the real world, so to speak, says the Stipler. It happens. And if that's the case, l'inyan lios chover b'parlament. Halokam parlament shel umos b'chol makamos. Yiskimu kol do Yisra b'daro shel panenu. Shunyan nachos v'lo raf raf adam me'olam. Shabuzet Yisra. Throughout our history in the Golus, we always had a sense, certainly within very respectable circles, of Frum Jews trying to be involved in the government, right? Whether it's the Abarbanel or others, even in the Polish government. Or Meir Shapiro, the Lubliner Rav, the founder of the Daf Yomi, was in the Polish parliament. So that is the Stipler. So they could be in this Polish government, they could be in the Israeli government. The whole purpose is they'll do Hishtadlus and they'll get more money for Torah and more money for the Frum community. Things that, again, are all very real to us now, if you follow Israeli political parties and Israeli politics. But he says that that's the case. Then on the left-hand column, he says, therefore, you should support the Agudas Israel, you should support everything they're doing. He says, it's unbelievable what he says, it's really fascinating. He says, no, Aval ha'pol le'agudas Israel, left-hand side, kil klum od, ki mitok lihitasam l'toeles chomrios, levadrim rachmano l'tzlana ikrei inyani yayadus. The Stipler himself is being critical of his own party, so to speak, of the Aguda, because they're constantly running after material support from the State of Israel. They want to get money, money, money. And again, we see this unfortunately this very day. This is what the Stipler's letter. He says, and they're forced to compromise on principal issues and religious issues of the character of the state, or the land, maybe he'd prefer if I use that word, because they want to get... So that's just, again, an interesting footnote. I mentioned it, it's a fascinating letter, a fascinating issue. I only mentioned it for the one reason. It sounds like the Stipler held that it was also to establish the State of Israel. Bavadai b'tchila ha'yishlo kedim. Sounds like he's agreeing, at least on that one point, with the Satmar Rebbe, as he understood the Gemara, based on the Megillas Esther. Now, the major point of departure, even among people who would follow the Stipler, is what do you do ex post facto? Now that we have a state, do we, so to speak, keep our heads in the sand and pretend it doesn't exist, which was the Satmar approach? Or, as the more mainstream Aguda approach has been, well, now that it's here, you know, let's get what we can out of it. Let's see, because why not? That is already echoed here in this letter. So here is essentially the first argument. We started off saying, what are the arguments against? The first argument advocated with varying degrees of extremism, but it's an objectively, an argument, a logic argument. The premise of the State of Israel, or Zionism and the national return to Israel, is a violation of this famous Gemara in Masechta Zuz. Yes?
Yes, this Gemara seems to fly in the face of another Gemara, which takes the Jews to test in the times of Israel.
We're going to get to it. We're going to get to it.
Okay.
I feel bad. You wanted to ask a question so badly, and now I'm going to tell you we're going to get to it. Harry.
Yeah, Rabbi, it's interesting that I noticed that in the Stipler's comment, he refers to the Poel Agudat Yisrael. Interesting, because I was just looking at this, the Baal, you know, this post-Torah in the World Zionist. Okay. Among the sponsors.
Yeah, I don't know enough about the nuances of all the parties.
Among the sponsors, okay. Listed,
I'm not sure if that's what he, if he's referring to the same group or not. I don't know.
So there must be some
a spectrum.
Of Ashkoffer.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there's many shades of gray, or I guess better yet, for now we'll say many shades of black. Yes.
How does the Stifler's
perspective? Right. So I cannot speak to the Stifler. I think it's a good question. The Satmar Rebbe himself, again, I'll spell out for you. For example, if it appears that a lot of incredible things have happened in the state of Israel, like a lot of them, whether it was the War of Independence, the Six-Day War, the raid at Entebbe, which was a big thing, a lot of things. So on the other extreme, we have the religious Zionist community, certainly the most extreme version of the religious Zionist community, speaking about Nisim and like Tanakh and Brachos and Hallel, and sometimes you get a sense they want to shech karbonos and haftoros and blow shofar. That's one perspective on that. Look, it's Hashem talking to us. He's doing anything for us. So I don't know what the middle would say. It's a good question. And we have two more parts, so we're not done yet. But I tell you what the Satmar Rebbe says, and this is perhaps the most extreme. He says it's the Maisa Satan. He calls it the Sitra Achra. It's certainly supernatural. He agrees, interestingly enough. But it's on the other side. It's the devil's doing, so to speak, to borrow a term. Others have pointed out that this is an incredible... I mean, I once heard a Gadol of Yisrael say, I won't say his name because I don't think he meant this to be publicized, I think it's Apikarsus. We don't believe in the devil. But there's no question, and the truth is, as things were occurring, Six-Day War, again, on the religious Zionist end, that raised their fervor, but that raised the tension on the Satmar side, he started becoming even more radical. He has a second sefer called Alagulav Alatmura. If you read it, again, at least to my ears, it's like I can read Vayel Moshe. He's forced to say all sorts of things to justify that, you know, you see things that are happening. So he comes up with all sorts of questions. But you're right, it would seem to be an issue. Yes. I'm going to take one more question because we have so much to do and we're only at the beginning. Yes.
2 points.
Yes.
1 point is that there was an arrangement also for settlement in South America by the boat. We're all there on Hirsch. And this failed, even that they went over there and it didn't take me. So to show that.
Uganda might not have worked either. It's got to be Eretz Yisrael, yeah.
And another point is that here they're saying here that in the Gemara they're saying that Ich Boshet Ha'aretz Ben Hoska. But the Zionism movement at the beginning was a peaceful movement,
okay,
and all of that, and there was no anything that was related to.
We'll get a little bit to one of your points, of what you're alluding to. But again, it's also worth noting, again, without getting into the whole history, but you know, there was plenty of violence. There was violence, Jew against Jew, right? We have Yigun and Haganah. There was a famous Salada. There were different things, right? When Rabin became prime minister, this was discussed, and other things with Sharon. A lot of things were happening in Free State. That's not so simple, right? The King David Hotel. They took up arms. I'm not saying they were justified. I'm just saying it wasn't like a Gandhi movement. Just I'm not saying it should have been, but it wasn't so simple. But the idea that, at least when it started, the idea of making Aliyah per se a mass movement to Israel, is that a violation of Kachoma? So far, all we've seen is some people say yes. Now let's see what the various answers are. Look, we have a Gemara. We have Gedolim. So what would be the answers to those, if you will, who would disagree? So there's an article that was written by Rav Shlomo HaKohen Aviner, if you know the name, in Beit El, is the rabbi, right? And Atzeret Kohanim, prominent religious Zionist Rosh Hashiva and Rav. He has an article in a journal called Noam. I'm going to quote from it subsequently, but I can't remember how many years ago it was. It was 20th volume of that journal. Where he collects 13 different answers among other Rabbanim, Poskim, etc. that have a very different view of this Gemara than do the school of thought we've had. So I'm not going to give you all 13, although I give you the bibliographical reference, and I have the article, a copy, if anyone wants to Xerox it from me. You can read the 13 answers against the Satmar Rebbe, against the Mikkel Fester. But we'll do a few of them tonight, just a few. So one answer, which to me is probably the right one, because it's just the most obvious one, is alluded to in a number of sources. So for example, the Pnei Yoshua, a classical commentary on the Gemara, see, he asks the question, the Gemara Masechta Yuma is critical of the Jewish people for not having more on Mas Aliyah in the time Ezra Nehemiah. And not only that, it uses the same metaphor of Kachoma, like a wall. So the two Gemaras seem to contradict each other. So leave aside what the answer is. What's important is the way the Pnei Yehoshua formulates the question, in which he says, in the middle of the page, the underlined part, Va'agados chalukos hein. True, it's a contradiction, but he makes it clear that neither of the Gemaras are meant to have any halachic significance. They're agadazos. Agadazos are important. They teach us lessons. We should try to understand what is the hashkafa behind this idea of shol yalu b'choma. But the idea that that would impact human behavior, to regulate it the way a halachic text would, so the Megillas Esther thinks it's a halachic text. That's why he says there's no mitzvah Yishuv Eretz Yisrael anymore. But since Bnei Yehoshua, in passing, but it's clear what he means, it's not a halachic text, there's nothing to talk about. Not only that, the Avnei Nezer, the famous Avnei Nezer, the Sukkot Shavu Rebbe, who was alive at some of this time, there's many other issues relating to Aliyah at that time with the Sukkot Shavu Rebbe has, which I'm not going to have time to get into, but he has a number of arguments against this understanding of the Gemara, one of which is, if you see on the left-hand side, the first part of that underline, Toloi v'divrei agada. They asked him, what's the answer? He says, it's not so simple to say. With halacha, there's rules, there's clear-cut principles, it's like, so to speak, more like science. We have principles, we have rules, we can analyze things. But agada, that's much more like, if you will, like art. It's a lot more gray and supple. So says the Avnei Nezer, this is all agada. I'll do better than the Avnei Nezer. I'll even do better than the Pnei Yehoshua. The Rambam, he has a very famous letter, again, I don't have time to go into the details back in the letter, but I'm sure you've all heard of his Igeres Teman. It was a big challenge to the religious community in Yemen, not only in our day, not only in the 20th century, but even in the Rambam's time. The Rambam wrote a very famous letter to give them chizuk, to give them strength and inspiration. And if you look at the bottom, the Rambam refers to this Gemara, and he says, the Hizbiya Ha'uma al Derech Moshel. And he doesn't use the word Agadata, but it seems clear that this means you shouldn't think that this is a halachically binding oath. Who dug up and made this Rambam famous, ironically enough? The Satmar Rebbe. You gotta give him credit for intellectual honesty. If you look on the left-hand side, I won't read it, I'll just paraphrase it. The Satmar Rebbe quotes this. And he says, he asks a number, he shows for a number of reasons why you can't say this is a halachically binding oath. He says, that's what the Rambam is getting at. The true is not a halachically binding oath, the way you would learn about Masach Shavuos. You know, Kol Nidre and that kind of stuff. But he says, nevertheless, the Gemara used the term Shavua, because we know, halakhically Shavuos, this is why we start Yom Kippur like this, Shavuos, Nadarim, oaths are very, very chumur. They're one of the most serious parts of halakha. So Satmar Rebbe says at the bottom that this is what the Rambam was referring to. All the Rambam meant when he said it was Derech Moshul, is Shehu Inyon Chomor Ma'od, Gam Yimeladei HaShavua. Even if it's not a formal Shavua. But it uses that marshal, that's how he reads the Rambam, uses the metaphor of a shvua of the Gemara to show you how strict and strident it is. Now, I personally am not at all persuaded by the Satmar Rebbe's reading of that Rambam. I think it's much more likely that the Rambam meant, the way the Pnei Yehoshua and the Avnei Nezer are more explicit, this Gemara is not meant to be taken in any meaningfully regulatory, so to speak, or behavioral way, because all it is an agadata. What it means, what the hashkafa is, that's a different question. And agadatas are famously difficult and need to be unlocked, and they're mysterious in their own way. But it would be a different realm of discussion if you understood it that way. That is more or less, if you will, school of thought number one in understanding the Gemara, unlike the Megillas Esther and the Satmar Rebbe and the Sefer. School of thought number two is, if you will, I'm going in gradation, if you will, to the following arguments. The original, the earliest source for this is Rav Shlomo Kluger, a famous Achron and Posek, who was a prolific writer. He has a Haggadah that I have for years been trying, but yet never been able to get my hands on. So I've never seen this inside. But there is a two-volume work written by the late Rav Menachem Mendel Kasher. Menachem Kasher was an encyclopedic genius. If I'm not mistaken, in his personal, he was a Ger Chassid. That was every picture I've seen of him. He's wearing a spodok. But he was also, it seems, a huge tzioni. And he wrote a number of books, including this Hatzkufa Gedola. Hatzkufa Gedola is talking about our day and age. He's talking about the Six-Day War, Halal Yom HaSmut, all those topics. And he uses, for those who are familiar with his encyclopedic knowledge, he brings to bear all of his intellectual powers as he's quoting and arguing and discussing. And I benefited much from his work. So he quotes this from the Rav Shlomo Kluger's Haggadah. So, if Kasher knew everything, and he had every book ever. So I trust him that it's there, but I have to say, honestly, I have not been able to track it down. That's why I quoted to you here secondhand from Rav Kasher. And I just found on Friday for the first time that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, that Sal, apparently also has made a similar argument. And more or less, it's to say as follows. Even if you'll grant that in the halachic shvua, let's keep a context. It wasn't in a vacuum. It's one of three. Two for one party, the Jewish people, and one very important one for the Umos Olam, for the non-Jewish world. What was their shvua? That they wouldn't persecute us too much. So we'll argue about what the gradations are of too much. But I have to tell you two things. Number one is the halacha in Shulchan Aruch, that if two partners make an agreement, and each one promises to do one thing as a mutual reciprocal agreement, the Shulchan Aruch paskens, and it's of course intuitive, if one side breaks their word, then the second one is freed from the arguments and from the commitments that they made themselves. This is what Rav Shlomo Kugler says, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik says, you'll quibble, the way Rav Aaron puts it, certainly once you get to the Holocaust, Shtabdu Yoser Midai. They've done too much. They have not lived up to their end of the bargain. They've persecuted us way too much. And therefore, essentially, our reciprocal shvua that we won't try to, so to speak, leave them, rebel against them, forcibly take back Eretz Yisrael, even if it means everything that the Sadr Rebbe thinks it means, it doesn't matter because it's no longer operative since they broke their end of the deal and there was a reciprocity assumed between the shvuas.
What does the Sadr Rebbe say?
I don't remember exactly. I read the entire essay. I've read it in bits and pieces. But one could theorize a number of things. Who said the reciprocal? You know, plus, you could also point out that the Sfat Rebbe, when he was talking about that Avnei Nezer, he himself had already granted that maybe you can't analyze this in strictly Hilchos Shvuos perspective. Now, obviously, Rav Shlomo Kluger disagreed. But once it's not a formal Shvuah, and even that, he agreed to that, so then maybe he also gains the fact that he won't be bound by the obligations of reciprocity. He probably says something like that, or even more ingenious. I'm not sure, because he hasn't answered everything. But that is a second argument against him and those from that school of thought. The third, and the one that I want to mention, which is the biggest and most prominent one I think you'll find in a number of sources, is perhaps first hinted at by the Marsha, but it's hard to read because it's very small, and it's not so well known from there, but you should just know this goes back at least as early to him. Again, he's obviously not talking about modern Zionism, but in principle, the way he understands the Shvuah was picked up on, and this is most important because it relates to our history, the history I briefly summarized in the lecture, by none other than the great Rav Meir Simcha of Zvinsk, the author of the Meshech Chachma on Chumash, the Or Sameach on the Rambam, and one of the great, great 19th century Gedolim from Europe. The Or Sameach, there's a biography, there's a number of biographies about him, one of which is called Rabbeinu Meir Simcha HaKohen, written by somebody named Rabiner. And he and others have copied this, Rav Kashrut quotes this also, has a very famous letter that he wrote in the aftermath of, I mentioned that in San Remo, they voted to officially, the League of Nations voted to endorse the partition plan. So in light of that, the Or Sameach wrote a letter. And he writes about how the Zarchu Kavei Or, that so to speak, there's been like this great awakening in his day, and light, you know, the rays of light are shining on certain Balabatim, he quotes Montefiore, and certain Rabbanim, like Rosi Hirsch Kalischer, who I mentioned, and there's been a whole new spirit, this Chovei Tzion, this whole movement of turning back the clock, so to speak, trying to get back to Eretz Yisrael in a great way. He writes that there have been many people who've been critical of this. He said that even though there are many Rabbanim who supported it, there are others who've wanted it supported. Look where I have it underlined on the right-hand side. Osam Shaiva Libam Lakaiva Sadavar Samuyad Lepeh. But they silenced themselves. They were scared of the people who were going to write, treif, right? They're going to hang up settles on the wall. You're not from, you're not pikaris. Rabbanim can sometimes get intimidated. It's a reality. And the Or Sameach is aware of it. He's writing. He says, there are more people, more Rabbanim who would have supported this. But they were, so to speak, scared by this. Nevertheless, what was the argument against? Bipnei Gimel Shvuos, Shishbiya Libnos Yisraelayim. It all goes back to this Gimel Shvuos problem. So what did he say on the left-hand side? Amnam. However, Ke'et. Asiba ha'ashkacha. Asherba asipas ha'mamlachos ha'noraos besen rimo. Niten or nothing. Sav. Asher Eretz Yisrael tiel am Yisrael. He says, it's all different now. Because the world, these Umos Olam, who we're not supposed to rebel against, they themselves and the League of Nations gathered together in San Remo, and they made the decision, Eretz Yisrael should go back to the Jewish people. Not all of Eretz Yisrael at the time, I was only a part. Kivan Shasar Pachan Hashvuos Uberishon Hamalachim. And now, because of this, there's no more Shvuos. There's no more problem with it. And because of that, the mitzvah called Ish, I'm sorry, therefore, because of this, this mitzvah Yishev of Yisrael is back where it comes. It's Chazer L'Mekomo. We couldn't do it for thousands of years. We couldn't do it. Perhaps maybe because of the Gimel Shavuos, but says the Or Sameach. Now, they're not against us. They want us to go. And therefore, he concludes, mitzvah I'll call Ish L'Sayeya, Kifi Yichol Oso, L'Kayim Mitzvah Zu. He's talking about giving support for Shivat Zion, which he was a supporter of. There's an entire chapter in this book about his relationship to that early Zionist movement. He was a very big supporter of this. And the basic premise which he outlines is that the whole notion of this Shavua is only when we are trying to retake Eretz Yisrael against the will of the nations of the world. But if they are allowing us to go, so that was never what the Shavua was ever about. If you look carefully, the Maharsha already says this. He's speaking about the time of Bayis Sheni. He says people were asking Ezra Nehemiah, how could you go back to Eretz Yisrael? And what they didn't realize, says the Maharsha, because it was Bereshus Koresh. It was the king had given them permission. So that's the same principle as the Or Sameach is enunciating in this very, very famous letter. Not only is it the Or Sameach, the great Avnei Nezer in two tshuvas says the same thing. And the Avnei Nezer here in the tshuvas I have beneath you, he says, for example, at the end of the first line, Aval im hisig reshus la'alos lis yashev shama shuv mechuyev la'alos. Once the Goyim give us permission, then of course there's no problem. Sheim yutan reshus l'kol Yisrael la'alos lo yashev sh'olin kachoma. The whole idea of a wall, he says, what's the metaphor of a wall by force? That's against their will. But if they're giving us permission, what's the problem?
Which Goyim are you referring to?
Oh, good. We'll get to the Sefer. Are you talking about, well, just, let me, I think I may know what you're asking, but I'll let you spell it out. What do you mean? Okay, so one thing for sure, no one seems to care about the Arabs. Tape was on, but okay. No one's going to listen to this, will be bothered by that statement. No, I'm serious. You don't see anyone ever in that discussion who speaks like that. Perhaps the reason is, in all seriousness, it's because they had no legal standing to care. The quote-unquote nations of the world that apparently the Rabbanim who took this seriously were worried about. So there I thought you could have two possibilities. One is the world community, which, again, that's why there are some echoes quoting the League of Nations, etc. And the other possibility, which we'll get to momentarily, are those who are, so to speak, occupying it themselves, the British. So that, you have both, you do have discussions about the League of Nations and the world community. Oh, well, very good. Very good, so we'll see that mentioned in a soon bit. Your Mechavez versus Yehuda Cook. I mean, it's also a fact, it's a historical truth, but the notion of making that point is something that's not yet.
From a historical point of view, it was the Western nations, beginning with the British and then the League of Nations, which
right.
And then once you look at the war against the Arabs,
right,
as a defensive war, because the issue was already established.
You understand completely. So just to add something to you, the Avnei Nezer, when he makes the same point, again, it's the same thing that Rav Meir Simcha said, but he specifically is hangs his hat, if you will, I guess more precisely, his strimal, the Chassidish Rebbe. He hangs his strimal on Rashi. What did Rashi say? Bechozek. It can't be by force. But this is not by force. This is with their permission. He writes in the second tshuva that somebody wrote him a letter and pointed out that there's a sefer. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's by Jason Eifschitz on the Haftoros. And there, a particular Haftorah, I think it's in Yeshaya, apparently, I haven't seen it since I either, but apparently, Jason Eifschitz says explicitly, apparently, that even if they'll give you permission, it's still usher to go. Somebody wrote that to the Avnei Nezer, and he responds in the second tshuva beneath you on the bottom of the page. Dimrei drasha heim, that was a nice drasha by Vincent Eifschitz. The Elef Kiyotavim, and even if you'll find me a thousand more sources like it. Lo yazizu dimrei Rashi mim koma. Halachically, bottom line, this is Rashi's pshat is the correct one. Rashi says you can't do it by force. The League of Nations is giving us permission that it does not constitute being by force. So now you'll ask me, Marcel, what does the Satmar Rebbe say to this? Turn the page. On the right hand side, again, the Sefer of Yoel Moshe, he essentially makes the argument as follows. And he quotes the Avnei Nezer. That's somebody that he certainly knew about. not because he's Chassidish Rav, so he obviously respected him even more. Chassid to Chassid. So he says, I know it's a little small, I'll paraphrase most of it, but he basically said, listen, it doesn't matter. So first, the tension, Isaac, of the British versus the League of Nations, I'm not sure if he's right historically, but what he says is, Im kol shar umos shebechol ha'olam yomru l'Yisrael limrod b'ha'uma shiyoshin b'neihem vadish em b'zahed to limrod. Came to talk to him, Rita. First of all, who cares what the League of Nations says? They're not the Balabatim. The British, I think he doesn't use the word British, but I guess that's what he's referring to. You can't rebel against the people who have control of Eretz Yisrael because someone else told you to. It all matters about them. And then he adds a second point, which is the Im Ha'aliyahu al Kalponim Biyad Chazaka Ein B'koach Kol Sharum Mislahadir. Basically, he disagrees with the whole premise. It's not up to them. We are not allowed to be instigators of the return. And if we are instigators, it doesn't matter, he doesn't care if we take up arms or not. The point is, you know, we're not coming just happenstance, coincidentally, a million individuals decided to make Aliyah. There's a movement. And that movement, he thinks, is a violation. Zehudavar Pashut, Uvarar Avlefi Das Avnei Nezer. I don't know if that's true or not, but he suggests that even Avnei Nezer would say, even if the other government allows it, that's why you and I can move there, or something to that effect. But the idea of a movement, the chazaka, so he thinks that's a problem. That's one response that he gives. There's a second response, which I didn't find, I didn't have a chance to put it inside the original, but if you look here, I have a footnote from Rav Kasher. So first of all, look at something very fascinating. Rav Kasher quotes the Satmar Rebbe numerous times in the Sefer, and he never does it by name. So for example, in this footnote, Reisi Lamachaber Mefursum Pesifro, a famous writer in his book, Sadvan. I don't know why. I can imagine two opposite reasons. Sometimes you don't quote somebody dafka out of disrespect. But there are other times, I know this myself, there are times where I'll, whether it's teaching or writing, where I'll want to very much disagree with somebody, and I'll dafka not mention their name out of respect for them. Because even though I may disagree with them on that point, I don't want, so to speak, the listeners or whoever I think may be hearing or reading this, as I lose respect for the person. So I don't know, I'm not even going to guess. But for whatever reason, Rav Kasher, to the best of my knowledge, every part of the book that I've read, he never mentions the Rebbe by name, but it's obvious that he read the book, and he even quotes from it the Machaber HaMefursam. So he quotes a different part of the Sefer, where the Satmar Rebbe also takes to task this Avnei Nezer, and makes the following argument, what he says, let me find the part that is important for us. Yeah, if you look at the part where I have it underlined, really, it makes a slightly nuanced point, which I was alluding to before, but here he says explicitly, that even according to Rashi, Kisha'aliyah biyachad, yesh lehem shama yad chazaka, kolomer hitzchazkus yisera. In other words, again, individuals versus a mass movement. As far as he's concerned, even Rashi would be a problem. Rashi says, b'chozek, with strength. So strength doesn't just mean that we take weapons and we bomb the British. Strength means that we all come together. It's our strength. We're coming together. That is, doesn't matter that they're giving us permission. It doesn't matter. We come together, and that's a violation of the Shavuos. So if you look at just Rav Kasher, he says very sharply and short and succinctly, Perusho, he's referring to the Satmar Rebbe of Rashi, his understanding of Rashi, who drushi, below pshat. Divreha Avnei Nezer Brurim, Shabbat Chazaka, Perusha Poshut, Lirushus, Lanikra, Biat Chazaka. So you have an argument about that one word. Perhaps one could suggest that the religious validity of the entire state of Israel hangs on one word of Rashi. What does that mean when Rashi says it with strength, B'chazaka, B'chozek? Avnei Nezer and the Or Sameach and others think it means with or without permission. And the Satmar Rebbe thinks it means in force or en masse. I think even that is a violation of Rashi. Now I want to skip for just a moment to show you two other views. I don't have time to read them inside at all. Just to mention, if you skip to the bottom of the next page, another esoteric source. I'm sorry, I don't have time. Give me a few minutes, okay? I'm trying to cover some ground. We're not going to make it. The Vilna Gaon has a commentary apparently on Shir HaShirim. This is also quoted by Rav Kasher. Not only did I not know about it, not only did I not find it in Baltimore, but as some of you know, in the past when I had trouble finding Svarim, specifically for this project, I called the YU Library. Thursday, I traveled to the YU library to do research for this project. And even there, they didn't know about it or couldn't find. They probably have it on a bookcase somewhere, but the librarians could not find the Vilna Magon's Parish. It's probably included in some other book, and there's so many versions and volumes of the Gra, that yet I've been unable to find it inside. But once again, quoted by Rav Kasher, he says that the whole Shavuot is that we're not allowed to go up and build the Beis HaMikdash. Now, you know, there happens some crazy Zionists who want to build the Beis HaMikdash. So about them, we'll all agree that that says the Gra is against the Shavua. You can't try to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash before Mashiach comes. But anything else, apparently, the Gra said, it's okay. And certainly, historically, we have right, the Gra was the inspiration for the significant Aliyah that occurred by the students. So that's an interesting source. And finally, if you turn over the sheet to the last, second to last page there, I just have something from the Maharal. The truth is the Maharal is a much more complicated personality than I'm even making out, because there's two different sources of the Maharal, and one of them really is a major source, or at least a potential source, for the Satmar Rebbe. He makes a big deal about the Maharal. But the truth is, that's not per se the one that I have here for you, but here the Maharal seems to say essentially that the whole idea of a Shavua is a misnomer. It wasn't that we were given an oath and made the promise that we wouldn't return to Eretz Yisrael. The way he says it twice, is that Shavua means Gzeira. In other words, we were punished, we were sent in the Golis, that we won't be able to. But if we are able to, so what's wrong with that? Obviously Hashem has said, I'm up for the punishment. Just like when Hashem sent us in the Mitzrayim. So he sent us there, it was Gzeira to be in Golis, and then Hashem said it's time to come back. So the Maharal goes out of his way to say more than once that they're not meant to be oaths. They're meant to be Gzeiros. I guess so, presumably. If you'll turn back to the sheet we had been on, I have a few more things to mention. One, I have there in this article by Aviner, he quotes the newspaper HaSofer from the beginning of the year Shnas Tavshin Lamed Dalid, a few years ago, interview with Rav Yehuda Cook, that's of course the son of Rav Avram HaKohen Cook, and when she says something very first, he says simply, this again, he repeats the notion that if it's with permission, then we're allowed. And then he says something really a little bit more radical. He says basically what Aaron referred to before, that even the British, it's not a rebellion against him, them, they weren't the legitimate, so to speak, inhabitants of our land. Ella mandatorium. They right there, this temporary mandate. But then he adds, very, you know, from his religious perspective, the British were just holding it for us until we were ready. Right? And then once they didn't do what they should have come, then it came time for the British to be removed, and Hashem made sure that that happened. But again, it's premised on that. I want to add something else. Not only is there an argument, a whole school of thought that says it's with the permission of the non-Jewish government, then it's okay. One of the other arguments that's strongly made, if you will, in Zionist circles, is that there is a number of sources that suggest that far from being surprising or somehow inappropriate or illegitimate, that our return to Eretz Yisrael and potential geula is taking place via non-Jewish governments. There are some very significant primary sources that suggest, for whatever mysterious reason, that the third geula is supposed to occur dafka by way of the permission and the help of non-Jewish governments. Who dug up these sources? Again, they existed well before him, but, you know, when we were schlepping around Europe, avoiding one pogrom and one massacre, and tried to have a little herring and learn a little bit, so Jews weren't thinking about geula. So there were certain books that just weren't being read. That was one of the chidushim of Sefer Kalisher, is all of a sudden he had everyone's attention focused, for better, whether they agreed with him or not, on all these issues. And he dug up two comments, one by the Ramban, it doesn't get better than that, and the Radak, also two primary shonim. If you look, I have both sources. The Ramban is on Shir Hashirim, the Radak is on Tehillim. They both say explicitly, I'll read just what the Ramban's line is, and how will it occur? He's telling you what the timeline will be in the third Geula. And finally, it will be Berishion Malchei HaUmos U'Ba'azarasam Yelchul Eretz Yisrael. With the permission and help of the non-Jewish governments, we will return to our land. Or the Radak, who says, B'chein L'Osid Yisaviv Geulas Yisrael Al Yedei Malchei HaGoyim Shia Yeretz Rucham Peshachim. They will be inspired. They will bring us back. The truth is, if you look, this is really poignant. Who's the most famous in our day and age scholar of the Ramban? By Dr. Chevel. So he put together the Ramban al Torah and the notes, and he has footnotes, including on this commentary. If you look on the left-hand side, Rabbi Chevel and his footnote to that Ramban writes so powerfully, these things, Maras and Igra, it's too good to be true, it's unbelievable. How could it be? Shekein zachinu b'yameinu liros kiyum dvaro eila. Right? Chacham adif min avi, says Chevel. The Ramban is essentially a prophet. We see it in our own day with our own eyes. He's referring to the Hakamas of the state of Israel. We returned with permission of the non-Jews. That's exactly what the Ramban said would happen at the beginning of the Gula. Rosier scholarship makes a big deal about both of these because people in Europe were criticizing him. How could you say that? We don't have Mashiach yet. Mashiach will lead us back to Israel, not the non-Jewish government. And he says, no, you see from the Ramban and the Radak. So you'll say to me, Marcel, what does the Satmar Rebbe say about that? And the truth is, here he has actually some pretty good arguments. We turn over the page on the top, you have the Satmar Rebbe, he makes two very good arguments. One is, he says, and again, I apologize for the sake of time, I'm not reading it fully inside. He says, if you look carefully at both the Ramban and the Radak, well, it's true that they say that the non-Jewish governments will help in our return to Israel. Both seem to be very clear that that would occur after Mashiach has already come. Mashiach hasn't come anywhere yet. When Mashiach will come, so you think the non-Jews are going to disappear when Mashiach comes? They'll still be around. Mashiach will be here. And instead of us, so to speak, retaking the land by force, that's how he understands the Ramban and the Radak. Moreover, Sam Rebbe points out, if you look at the end of the Radak, he has a line where he speaks about why will all this happen? Shabbatchu b'Hashem, because we trusted in Hashem. Oh, well. Right, Herzl, who's declaring himself as Mashiach and Moshe Rabbeinu of his day, he wasn't trusting in Hashem. Oh, says the Sam Rebbe. You see, and I just want to point out to you again, I mentioned more than once that this debate can sometimes become emotional or heated. Look at the top line, I just read you. I feel bad, this is only because his language is so beautiful, but just to read you the opening line of this paragraph of Sam Rebbe, Hine, Hamaharsim Lako Geula Me'atzmam. These terrible people who are taking the geula for themselves, either hishtadlus maguna etzel haumos la'asos k'maaseihem. Right, they're doing these terrible, ugly, immoral, disgusting things by joining with the non-Jews to, so to speak, act like them. That's how he reduces Rotzir's kalasher, who quotes Ramban in the Radak, and he points out v'chol mi sheyesho moach v'kad kad go v'roach et v'roach v'tznim rosh em v'rem kulam. Anyone who even has a brain realize this is a misreading of the Ramban and it's not true. So you see, sometimes things get a little labyrinthic, even among friends. All Jews are friends, right? Very, very passionate. I think the simple answer, by the way, for Theodore Scholarship, is that his point isn't per se the timing. The truth is that the Ramban makes it very clear that none of us really have any full understanding of what the sequence of events or timing will be. There's so many different stages and people involved. Mashiach ben David, Mashiach ben Yosef, Olam Haba versus Yemos HaMashiach, Tchiyas HaMeisim, when did that come in? Different Haggadahs or Gemaras have different sequences or impressions that were shown him. The Rambam basically says, the Rambam actually criticizes people who spend too much time trying to figure all this stuff out. When it happens, we'll know. It's not going to, the Rambam says, their very famous line, it's not going to be Mosif, Ava V'Yira. He's very upset. This has implications for perhaps a different type of lecture series. But he's very upset with people who spend too much time worrying about the redemption in Mashiach. You can't figure it all out. When it'll happen, it will happen. So I don't think the Tzidkus Scholarship was focusing much on the timing of it. Who knows when it will happen in which order? But the notion per se that something great for our Geula can occur with the hands, through the messengers of a UN, a League of Nations, the British, etc. So in principle, that is not problematic, even though one might have guessed it would have been surprising. Shouldn't Geula happen through the Tzadikim, so to speak? It's not at all. It may be surprising, but it at least apparently has a real source, a base from this Ramban and the Radak. I want to conclude by mentioning one final issue. I should have mentioned at the outset that I think the pattern we had last year was we really speak for about an hour and 15 minutes, an hour and 20 minutes. So considering when we started, I still have a few more minutes to go. Two more pages, which is really one more big issue. One more issue. Very, very important issue. It's a parallel issue. I mentioned, I'm alluding to the fact that one of the criticisms, once you get past the Yom HaShavua, to be discussed in depth, it is an argument against, it is an argument not against, we had permission, it was this, it was that. And the second argument, you know, is almost, come on, is there really going to be a return to Zion through them? The UN? I mean, right? And certainly everything we know about the UN makes it even more and more surprising that they could have been an instrument to something good for the Jews. So that's one argument, which is the second argument mentioned. And there's a third argument, which is a very related argument, which is, forget the UN, how could anything good happen through Rishayim? Something good's going to happen through a Ben-Gurion, Herzl, then Avraham. You're going to build a state, a secular state. You think somehow that's a good thing? Hashem wants there to be a Jewish secular non from Eichel, Tarfus, and the Beilis. Such a state in Israel, and the Frum should join with them. There's an Israel called Hitzdarfus L'Rishayim. We can't join with Rishayim. How could anything good be coming of that? And again, remind yourself of just how secular and anti-religious the Zionists were, and unfortunately I have to say many still are. Much, much literature on that argument. Much. I had a pile this big. And that's only the research that I did. But I just picked one letter out to show you. And again, these are serious people who, I speak for myself, not only love and respect, I learned their Torah this very day from Elchanan Wasserman. He had numerous letters where he hammers and hammers and hammers home this point. I have one of the letters here. It is dated, I think it's dated right, Tafresh Sadi Dalid. And there he's writing to someone, one of the great Rabbanim Eretz Yisrael, Dushinsky, Ne'el Haredes. Right, not from the Tzion, Ne'el Haredes. They wrote him to ask, would it be permission for somehow the Haredi Rabbanim to be involved with the chief rabbinate? Top left hand side of the page. We skip to where the Maral was again. Second to last page. They asked him, could, forget the secular Zionists, could the Haredi be involved with the religious Zionists? So Rav Elchanan Wasserman writes back, you can't have anything to do with the chief rabbinate. Because he heard about them, that they supported giving money, Lekaren HaYesod. JNF. How? The rabbinate of Russia supports JNF. Every tree you ever planted, Chas V'Shalom. He says, how could you do it? How could you support JNF? We do a gamkein, ki kaspe Karen HaYesod hochen legadil kofrim lachis. This JNF, Karen Kayemet, they are there to support heretics, people who aren't just not from, but that they hate from kite. The imkein, hama'orer litmoch b'keren zeh, hu machti as harabim b'madrega hayoser nora. And that there should be firm rabbanim who are saying, give money to JNF. That's a horrible thing. They're causing the people to sin. And he writes, lulei, at the end of the paragraph, she'eni kadai, hayiti omer, ki'amachzik b'hatza azos, royal in a dosa. They should be put in chayrim. Anyone who would support such a proposal to join with them should be put in a chayrim. And then he adds, v'hine, final paragraph, no sof, in addition to this actual isser of his chabrus to Russia, being involved with Roshoyim. At this point in the letter, it's not clear who he's referring to. The JNF or the Rabbanim. But I think the JNF. Hisser shall his chabrus to Russia. Odiyem, he's a chil Hashem. A horrible chil Hashem. Because it'll show that somehow, if you support JNF, that shows you're saying you're doing it for planting trees or whatever, like all the other things that they do. If you support them, that shows you don't care. If you support those who support them, that also shows you don't care. So great Rabbanim should somehow be associated with this, even with 6 degrees of separation. It doesn't matter. It's a horrible, horrible thing. This is just Echad Mi Elif. I've been giving you 1,000 letters, 1,000 things. The Rosh Hashem is not next week and the week after when I get to discussing some of Rav Soloveitchik's views. Just to show you how radical he was within his family, I have a letter from Rav Elchanan Wasserman's Rebbe of Chaim Risker. And it might make you go white. And how strong a language. This is our Rav Chaim. This is the language that he uses. But a similar argument, a very, very compelling argument. Don't give me philosophy, and don't give me Gimel Shavuos, and don't give me the Ramban and Shir HaShirim and Geula. Simple. They're Rishayim. How can he be involved with Rishayim? And again, we all know, to our great pain, not only was there a certain truth to this in his day, what happened with the kids from Yemen, right, that forcibly made him not from, cut off the pay, horrible things, doing forced autopsies to their body. I mean, there have been some things that have happened inside of Israel. I use the word some in quotes. that cause us as religious Jews to be very uncomfortable. There's no question about it. We shouldn't be insensitive to that. So, I'll say not what would the Sabra Rebbe say to that, the Sabra Rebbe would agree. What would those who would perhaps take a different perspective say to this argument? So I wanted to share with you, finally, as we conclude, a point made in an essay by Aaron Soloveitchik. It was originally, I think, published in Hebrew, but it's the version I have of it comes from a collected sefer of his writings called Logic of the Heart, Logic of the Mind. And Rav Aharon makes two related points, both based on stories in Malachim Beis. In Malachim Beis, the end of the previous page that I have there, in Perek Zion, the Navi, tells us the following story. Again, if there are any Nas teachers here, I'm just giving a brief overview. Don't hold me to every detail. How about Yeshiva, please? She says the following. And basically, what happened in that case was that the Shomron, that is the northern part of Israel, we know that at that time Israel had been, we had our own civil war, divided into two kingdoms. So that was in the capital of the northern kingdom, the Shomron. They were besieged by the Syrians. And the Navi tells us a terrible famine. They had no food, they had nothing. They all thought they were going to perish. And the Navi tells us about four lepers. Chazal understand that this might have been Gehazi and his family. Gehazi was a horrible Russia, or others. The Rambam talks about whoever they were, but they weren't just lepers with a physical skin condition. They were Rishayim. And these four lepers said, even though everyone else was trying to hold out, they said, listen, let's walk to the Syrian camp. One or two things will happen. Either they'll have pity on us and give us food, or they'll kill us right away. But that's better than starving to death. So they led. And the Navi tells us here how when they get there, sure enough, they see everything's gone. They get to the camp, and everything's gone. They have fled. The Navi describes, Rosh explained, that Hashem made a miracle, and it made the Syrians hear the sounds of great chariots and horses, and they thought everyone was going to attack them, and they ran away. They ran away so quickly that they left all their gold and all their silver and everything. So here, it's reminiscent, by the way, of in our day, 1967, Rav Gaon and Hebron. Rav Gaon went there, thinking, who knows what's going to be? And he shows up, and they're all gone. The Syrians all ran away. The Israeli army comes, first time, ready to attack Hebron. Rav Gaon's waving the flag. It's just me. Just your chief rabbi of the army. Don't shoot. She went there, they were all gone. They ran away. So that's exactly what happens to these four lepers. Mamash, they saved the majority of the Jewish people when they went there. They were the ones. And in fact, it tells us how Yavau, they went to the tents, Yochlu, Yishtu, Visumi, some Kesef, Visav, Begadim, they took all the riches and they hid them. And then the pasuk continues, the part that I left off, and they said, oh, we're not doing the right thing, we should go. And they tell everyone else, guess what, you're all saved, right? They're still having a feast, the other people are still starving, they don't know that they're saved. They run and tell everyone that they're saved. So if you turn over the page, Aaron Soloveitchik makes one important point from that story. Letting everyone know that they didn't actually bring the deliverance. It's not exactly the same. But yeah, there's a better story. Keep on reading Malachim Beis. We have a different story, also very similar, but more powerful. Here the story is also, again, about the same king and the same kingdom, Yerovam ben Yoash, who the Navi attests for us, was as big a Russia as Yerovam ben Nevat. He's a horrible Russia. And yet, the Navi tells us, who heishiv et gvul Yisrael, he created a great salvation. He returned, he enlarged the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. In fact, the Gemara, Yerushalmi Masechta Chala, says that there was halachic significance to his conquest. The whole boundaries of Eretz Yisrael for the halachos of Mitzvot Tuis Baretz depend on this Russia's conquest. And there's a debate in the Gemara on what did he conquer, what would the boundaries be, but it's all based on the legitimacy, needless to say, of his conquest. Furthermore, the Navi continues, in such a case, why did it all happen? Kedvar Hashem, Elokei Yisrael, Asher Diber, Biyar Abdo, because this is what Hashem had prophesied. He mentions the Navi Yonah, etc. And then he mentions in the last pasuk here, Lo Diber Hashem Limchos Hashem Yisrael, Mitak Lashemayim, even though they were very vulnerable at the time, Hashem decided not to destroy the Jewish people, but rather of Yoshiim, Biyad, Rav Men Yuash. He saved them through this great Russia that five took him earlier, the Navi is telling us how big of Russia he is. He is the medium for the salvation. Based on this, Rav Aharon says in the final paragraph, Yerovam ben Yoash did not depart from the evil deeds, yet he restored the borders. Now the question arises, why did Yerovam ben Yoash, certainly no greater tzaddik than Ben Gurion, merit such a great privilege? In answering this question, we will also answer the question how any relief or any form of geula can take place the Jewish people and Jews have not prepared themselves through universal dependence. The answer is, last paragraph, quoting the Pasuk, that Hashem had said he will not destroy the Jewish people, so he saved them through the hand of Yerubim. During the reign of Yerubim and Yoash, had this deliverance not been realized by Hashem, the name of Israel would have been wiped out. Similarly, 800 years ago, in the time of the Rambam, and 500 years ago, in the time of the Shulchan Aruch, the Jewish state was not indispensable for the survival of the Jewish people. The Jewish people survived very well, they suffered, but they survived. And they blossomed intellectually and spiritually without a state. But after the experience of the Nazi Holocaust, the Jewish people could not survive any longer without a state. So what Rav Aaron did in this last point, which is a little bit controversial, is he went one step further. So just to review and make the final point, without his last paragraph, the basic point, he's there trying to say, why should it be? Let's say you don't want to ask why. Let's say you have a different answer, why. That's not the main reason I quote it. The main reason I quote it, and his main, and the strongest point is, can it be? And only can it be, we have a precedent in Navi. That Yeshua, or even a Gula, an expansion of, you know, a control of Eretz Yisrael, can absolutely take place through the hands of people who are great, great Rishayim. Now, again, you then could ask the question, which would be a natural question for a religious person to ask, why couldn't Hashem do anything? Why wouldn't Hashem have it a way that could be through the fruit? So he gives his suggestion. Again, it's coupled. You can't read these two paragraphs independent of each other. The notion which he said before of the non-from not being involved. Maybe if we had been involved, they wouldn't have to have been. But the answer is, but if it's them, if it's just the non-from, so how come Hashem says, okay, then you're not worthy. Why do you do it anyway? Even though the forefront of the leaders of that of the Return to Zion movement were clearly not loyal to the tradition. So this is his suggestion, that it was simply a time of need. We had a desperate situation for the Jewish people. We needed a return to Eretz Yisrael. And these were the people who Hashem therefore had to actually be. The issue of the relationship between the Holocaust and the State of Israel is, needless to say, a very complicated one, very sensitive one, and I don't want to be that. That's not my discussion tonight or the next 2 weeks. And I certainly don't want it to distract from the main point. So to sum up, just to review, we did a lot tonight. But essentially what we saw was that there are a number of arguments, halachic and hashkafic, that have and are still used against the nationalistic aspirations of other parts of the Jewish people, certainly the State of Israel, halachic arguments relating to the three Shavuos. We saw many arguments four or five against that argument. Perhaps most compelling, the issue that we're not violating it if the non-Jews have given us permission. It's not even a halachic text, etc., etc. We saw the passionate debates with the Sama Rebbe and others. We then saw a few other arguments. Number one, how could it be that there should be a geula, a return to Eretz Yisrael through non-Jewish governments? So that not only may that be okay, it may have been, so to speak, prophesied or predicted by the Ramban and the Radak. And finally, we saw the issue, which is still really to the heart of the matter, frankly, to this very day. Certainly, the ex post facto that we have a state, my own sense of why in certain circles there's still such vociferous antagonism to the state or to the government, it's this last issue of Arbalchana and Wasserman and many others, of the fact that they're not only not religious, they're anti-religious, they want to make us not religious. It's seen, and with good reason, by many, as a real milchama of secular versus religious. So obviously those within the religious community who have, so to speak, decided to take half a cake, half a loaf, and not to have none, so they obviously have had a different perspective that not only is it possible, but it's legitimate. Again, it shouldn't be mistaken, of course not. This is why I was pushing the vote this morning. Obviously, anyone who's religious would like there to be the character of the state to be much more religious. And it pains us as much, and it should pain us as much as the most radicalized Hasidic teenager that is driving us to Jewish Yerushalayim on Shabbos. If it doesn't hurt us that much, then there's something wrong with us. Whether our response should be throwing rocks or other things is obviously a different question. But the notion that there's something missing, this is only part of what we hope for, it should be obvious to anyone who's religious. Whether we take the part and approve of that, or we reject the whole, obviously that is part of the debate. And in Mirtz Hashem, we've discussed some of the extremes tonight. People talking about Geula, people talking about satanic and demonic forces. I hope next week my goal is to discuss, even among those who are still what we would call not Mizrahi, but to show how there's many shades of black and gray. We'll start with it hopefully next week, and hopefully culminating even the week afterwards to just show that even within the Mizrahi community, it's not exactly all one voice. We have a voice that's much more focused on Geula, redemption, Mashiach, and we have what I'll call the Messianic religious Zionists, but there's also a school of thought which is a much more pragmatic religious Zionist community, and hopefully through all of that we'll have seen the many shades across the spectrum. Thank you everyone for coming. Hopefully we'll see you next week at the home of the Strums.